Hello there, and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is sponsored and brought to you by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent bike insurance broker, they will bring you the exact quote you need for your bike, moped or scooter insurance.
Don't forget to please press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from so that you never miss an episode, or you can watch the whole show on YouTube right now.
Right then, it's another week. That means another fantastic guest talking things we love. Bikes, of course. Prust, it has to be the best job in the world. We love it.
It certainly is, my friend, because even though they say never meet your heroes, we get to do it on a weekly basis, and this is certainly no exception. Our guest today is a professional road racer who's decided that the Northwest 200 and the Isle of Man TT are anywhere near scary enough, which is why he's about to embark on another frankly terrifying adventure. It's the one and only Mr. James Hillier.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, James.
No problem.
I've got to say, the last time I was meant to see you, this is going to sound double Dutch, but I was really pleased I didn't see you, because we were going out for a ride in enduro bikes and my mate said, oh, there's a couple of tasty riders going to be there. And I said, who's coming? And they said, you. And I was like, oh no, because I'm very average. And then luckily for me, when we got there, my mate's bike wasn't working. So yeah, we couldn't fix it. So luckily, well, I would have loved to have gone riding with you, but I would have been about 5 miles behind.
Yeah, we must finish that ride sometime. It didn't start too well, did it?
It didn't, and I've sold the bike now. So, yeah, you might have to lend me one of your many bikes. So, yeah, I'd love to get out on you. But Prutz alluded to it there. I mean, the riding you do in terms of, you know, the different terrains, the different surfaces, the Dakar, which you're training for at the moment, I mean, I wouldn't really want to even do that in a car, the comfort of a car. It's going to be tough. But how grueling is that on two wheels? And how on earth do you train for it?
Your training is really difficult, especially in this country, because we have nothing like what you get over there in Saudi. It's hard, you know, and I think it was probably the positive side of it was that I wasn't going there to try and win. It was more to achieve it and finish. So I kind of knew I could adapt and learn as I went, and there was no pressure on myself to go fast. And if any doubt, I would slow down and kind of take it steady, I would say. So there was no big pressure on me in that way to go and kind of ride blind into unknown terrain. It was, there was a bit of everything there. And unfortunately, you know, I suppose the little bit like home was the rain. Last year when I did it, we had a lot of rain, and that was obviously affected the terrain, but it also made you pretty cold and wet at the same as well, you know, so it was another added issue to the whole bag of rally racing.
Does it help or hinder, James, knowing what's coming? Because it's, as you say, from a technical standpoint, it's a huge undertaking. I would assume that physically it's a huge undertaking as well, and it's an assault on the senses in a completely different terrain that you're used to on this side of the planet. So going into it, is forewarned, forearmed?
I think I'm laughing because I think I'm still getting over it. Parts of it were quite traumatic, but you know, I think the first time I was better not knowing. If I knew what I knew afterwards, which seems totally bonkers, the fact I'm going back. But if I knew what I know now, I probably would have talked myself out of going on my own the first time.
Right. Okay.
So once I found out, you know, some of these things, it was too late and I was already in it. So I had to, you know, and there's no way I was giving up. So, I'm not going to lie. I have questioned my logic in returning for another go, only that this time I'm going with a team, so I will have some help, and I'll have a bunk bed in the trucks with a proper mattress and hopefully a duvet rather than a sleeping bag. But I could talk to you for hours on trying to explain just how grueling it is, but it wouldn't really even scratch the surface, I don't think.
Is it the equivalent, I'm assuming, something like, you know, I've done the London Marathon a number of times and I hate it and it's horrible. But then a few years ago, I did a 100-mile run and I just thought, never again. This is brutal. Because I think people look at motorbike races and think, yeah, you're obviously really skillful, you're good at what you do, but you are proper athletes, and to get through that, I mean, it's a huge endurance feat, isn't it? Just to finish it. I mean, how hard is that compared to it? Can you compare it to the TT or any other form of racing, or is it so different?
I think it part the intensity is similar, possibly, to the TT, but the longevity and the relentlessness of it. You know, like day one of Dakar 23, one of the other guys in the group I was riding with, in the class I was in, we were all camped together, and he said that he'd done a few before, and he said, "Geez, that day was harder than any of the days of the previous Dakar." And I was like, "Well, great, you know, I picked a good one for my first
immaculate
first attempt." Yeah, so it was. I don't know. I can't compare it directly to anything I've done before, but it was a kind of punishment, I also kind of get off on that, I suppose, that self-punishment and suffering and learning how far you can push yourself or how far you can take yourself, you know, because if you were just, you know, I say to people like a number of things when in other sports, when you're training in the gym or lifting weights or running, say, when your legs are going that fast, you physically can't go any faster. But on a bike, when something happens and you have to find some odd inner strength to kind of turn the bars or force the bike to go somewhere where you have to find these and react in a way that you can't in any other way or prepare for, you know.
You mentioned, I mean, obviously, and the huge technical aspects of what the rally is the bike that you're on, obviously allied to the undoubted skill of the rider and ability of the rider. Just kind of for housekeeping purposes, what bike are you on, and what kind of modifications have you made to it?
Last time I was on a Gas 450, which is an Austrian produced bike, same as the KTM and Husqvarna, and it's a bike you can. I mean, they're special order, but they make around 75 of those a year, and you could buy one from your local dealer. And they come rally ready, bar a few electrical alterations, you know, for the navigation system and things. But they're pretty much ready to go with the big tanks. And, you know, gone are the days where you would modify a production bike with bigger fuel tanks and things. These bikes can come ready to go now. And this year I'm riding with it for a Chinese manufacturer, Covey, which is quite new to the game. This will be their third year competing at Dakar Rally, but for me it's a similar bike, but kind of new in a way. It will work in a different way, so I need to learn to sort of ride this bike and test it somewhat, but also know it inside out and upside down, you know, every nut and bolt goes together, and electrical connection, where fuel pumps plug in and things like that. So if anything does happen, then I'm in a position to be able to repair and rectify it.
It's quite KTM-ish, isn't it, in its design and the way that it's put together, because you see that we chat, and we'll hopefully come on to it in due course, about bike ownership and the type of bikes that Ewan and I ride, which are for posers, basically. But when I'm taking mine into a Triumph dealership to get it looked at next week, and what you will be met with is a fleet of these super machines with four different computers, the TFT, which all look amazing, but I presume A, you wouldn't do a Dakar on it, and B, if your screen goes tits up in the desert on the Dakar, and you're thinking, well, it needs to get plugged into the computer back at the dealership. I mean, I presume is it the more low maintenance the bike is, potentially the better it is to get you through the desert, James?
Yeah, for sure. Like simplicity, the less to go wrong, the better. So they're not over complicated like the road race bikes I use on the Isle of Man. They have ECUs, really advanced ECUs with traction and wheelie control, and then a logging system. So there's a lot more to kind of potentially go wrong there, I suppose. But the bike at longest is going to be run for an hour and 40 minutes before being rechecked by the mechanics, whereas this Dakar job is 2 weeks of kind of, you know, the less just simplistic, you know. We don't run rider aids or anything like that. It's literally a start stop button, lights, a horn, and then a power supply for the navigation system. So it's kept kind of stripped back and simple as possible.
How hard is it when you're doing a sport like yourself, like say, for example, our previous lives, the only thing that could go wrong is our bodies letting us down and getting injured. But you're out there doing the most grueling race on the planet and you're relying, as you say, on technology and you need to know your way around a bike, which you do. But how hard is it psychologically when you wake up in the morning, you're going to go to the next stage, you think, come on, bike, do not let me down. Because
pray
you're
to
not
the
relying
bike
just on your skill, are you? You're relying on the machinery not to break.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's obviously an element of luck, but I think also, or bad luck, I suppose, for something to fail. But I did everything in my power to make sure my bike was in the absolute best condition it could be. And also I rode it quite respectfully because I didn't want to wear anything out or damage anything. You know, I didn't want to over rev the engine. And if it got too rough, then I wouldn't. I rode probably quite a bit differently than if I was riding a much shorter race. You know, I rode quite sympathetically for the motorcycle and calculated, but there was also the element of, you know, I don't think I was going, you spend a lot of time on your own, you know, in that 2 weeks. So there was, I definitely spoke to the motorcycle a lot, although that sounds silly, but, you know, egging her through, and that was my, you know, we were best friends for those 2 weeks. So, you know, we went through quite a lot together, and I'm sure, you know, I'm not really superstitious, but I'm sure it helped just to kind of caress her through and get me to the finish.
I mean, it's funny you say that, James, because I mean, the closest I can get to that is wheeling mine onto the next petrol station when I've run the red light for too long, thinking, right, I'll be all right, it'll be all right. And that's on the M1. So to do it in the middle of a desert, I'd be at first, second, third, and fourth base with the bike if I wanted it to get through the desert and get you over to the other side. I mean, we spoke in the intro about Dakar obviously coming up. We talked to mentioned the Northwest 200 and the TT. Is there a different mindset for each one? I talked about them being scary, but the main theme of what you and I have really got out of speaking to so many wonderful people like yourself is that we look at it from our point of view, where you go, my God, that looks terrifying. But the kind of overarching theme is there's a healthy respect for the jeopardy involved, but the professional side of it, the ability side of it, is what sets you apart from mere mortals like us fanning around on motorbikes. So the question of it of one being scarier than the other is probably a bit of a misnomer. Is the approach to each one slightly different? When you've talked about the bikes, but then from an emotional and a mental point of view.
Yeah, I think to put it crudely or harshly, I suppose, like the way I see it is that TT, there's more chance of dying, not coming home. But at Dakar, that's less, you know. So from coming from that level of kind of fear, I suppose, fear, to Dakar takes the edge off, because there's the chance of that are quite a bit less, but it's still quite dangerous. At Dakar, there's a very good chance you're going to get hurt, and potentially very badly hurt. You know, it's almost like a boxer. I don't think there's anyone in history has ever finished a Dakar without some sort of injury. You know, it's you're going to get hurt at some point in the 2 weeks, not always from your own error, you know, you can get caught out, and we see regularly the top riders at Dakar dropping out because they broke bones or ligament injuries and concussion and things. So it's I feel like coming from the risk level at TT, I come down to Dakar, so it's a little bit more of a I wouldn't say like a kid's play area with the padded cushions, but it's a little bit of that, if I'm trying to kind of explain it right, you know. There's different levels, but they both require the utmost respect and discipline to kind of follow by, really, because I don't want to die and I don't want to get hurt. So it's kind of
pretty good fundamental trigger points, though. Yeah. Sort of thing to have just in general. Yeah.
What, a double point question here. What gives you the biggest buzz? Which race, and what gives you the most satisfaction when you go home? You see your family, look in the mirror, and you think, job well done. I've come back from the Isle of Man. I'm safe. I've done well. Or I've come back from Dakar. That was so physically tough. What gives you the most satisfaction, and what races gives you the most adrenaline, the biggest buzz?
I think by a long way, TT, the speed. You know, I like going fast, obviously, but I think TT is the ultimate buzz. Doing the speeds we do down A roads, you know, is unheard. You know, you just can't do that legally anywhere else in the world. But the whole, you know, the crossing that finish line at Dakar last year was like probably the biggest achievement I've ever made in my life. You know, to what I went through in those 2 weeks was sheer, like, just a total roller coaster of emotion and amazement, really. You know, I had to keep pinching myself that AR is actually there doing it. And I don't think you can beat the buzz, or I can beat the buzz and fix I get a TT from the speed. But in terms of satisfaction, even you know, when people say this, getting to the start line of Dakar is a massive achievement. So when I actually rode up onto the podium for the start of the prologue of the first day at Dakar, it was just like, it was quite emotional. I couldn't quite believe I'd made it. You know, it was so much work to get there. So it's certainly more satisfying in that way. Unless I've just kind of got a bit accustomed to the TT, you know, but, you know, I suppose I've done that quite a long time now. So it does, things become a little bit more normal, don't they, when you do them enough times. So,
like tearing around on A roads at 150 miles an hour.
Yeah.
it's amazing the way you can speak about it, James, and there's an obvious passion there. It just comes out of you when you're talking. So let's go all the way back then. Where does your journey on two wheels start to get from there up to Dakar, up to the TT, up to the Northwest 200? What first introduced you? Was it love at first sight when you set your eyes on these beautiful two wheel machines?
I can't specifically remember, but a moment or a point where I just always liked riding my pedal bike, and we lived near a big hill. And that was the best bit, was just going as fast as I could down the hill. I've always been a bit of a speed freak, I think. But
so it's been there from the start, whether it was powered or whether it was pedal.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think, like, I actually hurt myself more on pedal bikes than I have on motorbikes, ironically. So I try to stay off those now, to be honest. But my dad, he never raced, but he was into motorcycles, road bikes, and also my granddad was a motorcyclist. So they not to a competitive level, but mm-hmm. You know, I do remember, like, from a young age, any car journey, I would just be glued out the window looking for the latest motorcycles. You know, in the mid 90s, Honda Fireblades, mm-hmm. or, you know, a Ducati 916, or, you know, I'd go to Tesco's with my mum and just pestering her for the little model Maystone motorcycle. You know, I just sort of, you know, and then actually my mum, and it was 97, my mum and dad had separated, and the holiday that year with my dad was, me and my sister went to the Isle of Man TT races to watch. And I think that was, the seed was planted there and then, really. You know, it just stuck with me, and I couldn't, it was a dream. And I still pinch myself now that I go there each year. But, you know, it back then it seemed a million, I suppose it was really a million miles away. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but that was my sort of dream, and chased it since. So yes, quite, I wouldn't say magical, but just from something that seemed so far away at one point to be now doing it, I still genuinely appreciate every moment.
What a cool dad, by the way. Your mum and dad are broken up, and your dad's got you for the summer holidays. Where should we go? Euro Disney? Nah, I'm going to take him to the Isle of Man, watch some bikes racing around. Yeah. I mean, that's your dad sounds like a legend.
You're
that's
taking
awesome.
Them where?
It often happens that way, though, James. It often happens. We speak to a lot of people about their passion of bikes and how it started. And, you know, I'd say maybe 9 times out of 10, it's a father, or it's a grandfather, or it's someone who's introduced them at a young age into the two wheels. That happened for me. And, you know, it's just a lovely common interest you've got with that loved one. You know, like you said, your grandfather before your dad rode bikes as well. And it's nice. It's almost like it was meant to be.
I guess so. Yeah. I don't really know where the competitive side come from, but I got three children, two boys and a girl, and they all ride not really competitively. The eldest has done a little bit, but it's more it's nice to share that passion. And my oldest has shown a bit more interest now in the garage, and I feel like I just teach him little bits. Just some of it is just sort of basic common sense on how things work and how to get the best out of something and preparation to look after things. To if you're depending on a tool to get you through a job, then I think it can teach you quite a bit of life lessons and in respect and looking after stuff can is important. So
it's a great point to make, James, because obviously there's a whole strand of what my motorcycling is, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, of course, being at the forefront of that. Of you are doing that when you get on a bike. You're putting your trust in something because you are giving your life into it, aren't you? And you get so much emotional enjoyment and freedom back from it that, as you say, teaching your son how to... Well, the fact that, a bit like a body, everything's joined, isn't it? If one part of a bike's not working, then more often than not, it knackers the rest of it. So to teach him and use the analogy and the metaphor of what looking after a motorcycle is and what that can dovetail into his life as an adolescent growing up, it's a huge thing. And sometimes as well, and not going off on a tangent about how fathers and sons and adults and children talk to each other, it's like having that conversation, isn't it, in a car when they say, if you're going to talk about something that's embarrassing, get in a car because you're both facing forward and you don't have to look at each other. So you can talk about anything from the birds and the bees all the way up to whatever. I mean, not that there's anything more than the birds and the bees, is there? But the that ability to use the bike as a bit of a metaphor to perhaps say things subconsciously, unconsciously to the next generation, and for them hopefully to take it on board without thinking, here he goes, dad wants to teach me something. But when you're tinkering around with a bike, I suppose that type of conversation is a bit more free-flowing.
Yeah, it does. It's kind of lubricates the relationship, I suppose, a little bit. It's sharing that common ground. But on that side of it as well, with the communication thing, is me and my old school friends, we've done a couple of rides. We all had, I've still got mine, some of them have still got theirs, the Honda C90s. We did a couple of trips out with those to, well, a bit more than just a trip. We did Land's End, John O'Groats a couple of times. But we all had the intercom helmet comms on, and it was so nice just to have no distraction. We were riding, talking and reminiscing, and it was so good to kind of just chat, and kind of, there was no other distractions. Yeah. We were moaning about the odd car driver, but it was just us guys and some bikes. And it was really healthy, I think. It was at the end of the ride, we were a bit achy, but felt a lot better, And I think that's, I think for me, a big part of motorcycling, whether I'm riding, talking or working on my motorbikes, for me, is a release and, I suppose, an escape.
Yeah. A lot of people say that, don't we, perhaps? We talk to a lot of people, what is it about being on two wheels? And it's that freedom, that feeling of you could be anywhere. You're just, concentrating on the road ahead. You've forgotten all the life worries. And there's something magical about being on two wheels. Did you ever think as a child then, when your granddad and dad got you into bikes, did you ever think, one day, not only am I going to race bikes, I'm going to be able to work on bikes myself. I'm going to, because you do all sorts. You work in films as well, don't you, as a stunt rider, and you've done all sorts. Did you ever think you'd make a career out of being on, and still doing it, a great career out of being on bikes? Did you ever think that?
No, I'm I should be a bit more grown up than I probably act sometimes, but I'm nearly 40 next year. I still pinch myself often to realise, I qualified as an electrician when I left college, failed. I didn't get really any GCSEs, or I'm not very academic. I wouldn't say I was never going to make much of a living out of anything like that, but I got a hands-on trade electrician, but I used to dream. I think that motivated me, to be honest. I remember crawling around in loft spaces in the loft, insulation, putting cables in, thinking, geez, this is not what I want to be doing for the rest of my life. And I think in my early career, that drove me and made me that bit more hungry to succeed, So, it almost feels a bit wrong making a living from doing something I love, but I guess that's the goal in life is to, is to do that, isn't it? And kind of be able to get by enjoying life in general. And I count myself very lucky to be able to do that. But it's also been a lot of hard work to get where I am, you know.
You'd have to apologise for maturity on this podcast, guys, because Ewan's the oldest on here by a mile, and he's the most immature on the whole thing. I mean that in the most loving way, Ewan. You know that.
What's worrying is when you start, you kind of always stereotype people. And recently there was a guy, and he just looked really old to me. Like, I won't say it was, but and I kind of like just, I'd say I must have been judging him in some way, but he was actually younger than me, and it was a real reality check. Like, I thought, I'm actually, I struggle accepting getting old. So I think that's why I keep doing all these things, to kind of just keep trying to turn back the clock and cram more in.
You weren't trying to help him across the roadway, some geezer in his early 30s.
No, he wasn't that old. It's just funny.
Come on, mate. We'll get you across, Grandad.
It's funny where you place yourself in kind of the, A, maturity, but general actual physical age, yes, tree or table. Yeah, and then there's that point when you start or realise you're actually older than people you looked at as old, you know. So it's, you've got to work on that one.
The killer's when your adolescent son starts calling you old man, you think, cheeky little sod. But that's the life cycle, and it comes to us all, of course, isn't it? Anyway, quick bit of mid-show housekeeping for you all out there. If you haven't already, please press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from, so you never miss an episode, or you can watch the show on YouTube. Back to you, Ewan.
Yeah, I was going to say, James, I mean, obviously, you drive cars as well. You've got bikes. What is it about a bike that I think I know the answer to this, or maybe I don't. Do you race? You're on bikes so often. Do you actually quite enjoy driving a car, or is it always, if the sun's out, you're going to be on two wheels?
Do you know, I don't particularly enjoy riding on the road too much, because there's two problems there. Self-control, I struggle with a little bit. Because my kind of conception perception of speed and is quite different, you know, especially nearer the TT or just after, it is you know, what's normal to me isn't within the speed limits. So I get carried away. And then also other car drivers, you know, most are okay, and you know, but you just can't always count on others. So I prefer slower, older bikes, really. I think I'm more sort of capped, like my Honda C90, or I've got my granddad's old Triumph T120, which is, you know, sort of 60 mile an hour, and that is plenty fast enough. So it's, although it doesn't stop too well, but it's that, I still get that nice feeling, but I'm capped and restricted with what I could potentially do.
It's funny you should say about that C90, James, because, I mean, it's the old postal bike, isn't it? So the image that you've conveyed about you doing Land's End to John O'Groats with your mates, because there's that philosophical saying, which is speed is the enemy of reflection. So when you are able to do it and chat, yes, obviously you've got to navigate the whoppers that we all come across on the roads that just suddenly, oh, I didn't realise there was a motorbike there. Well, I've been here for quite a while, and if you looked in your mirror, you would have seen me a lot earlier than you did. So like you say, the C90, and it's the miracle of the engineering that it is, a very straightforward little bike that gets a lot of people from A to B. I read a book as well, someone had ridden one back from, I don't know, the Far East, which is just phenomenal, really, because it's just something to poodle around on, isn't it? And it's a completely different bike. Maybe you get your fix. That adrenaline buzz from a TT, from the Northwest, from the Dakar, which means that when you do get back to pootling around on English roads, maybe there's a contrast. Maybe that's the different sides of your psyche.
The Cub 90s are 21, and I feel like they're totally underrated, and people can judge me as they wish, but they're almost so bad they're good. But you know, it's always going to start and we'll nearly always get you to the destination. But last time I remembered, like last time I rode mine, I was sort of giggling before I got out of second gear. I was sort of giggling to myself and had that nice kind of feeling inside. And, you know, I don't know. Well, I can't explain what it is, but it gives me that feeling. I kind of thrive, I think. And, also proves you don't have to be going fast to kind of get that. It's sometimes just the general sensation you get back from the way a little engine's working through the chassis to drive them. Little skinny wheels with rubbish brakes, and it's just nice. You know, I enjoy it, and not everybody gets it. You know, I've ridden some amazing motorcycles, but a Honda Cub 90 would probably, I wouldn't say top three. I think it'd be probably in my top five motorcycles in the world, weirdly. You know, I don't think many people would say that, but for me it does.
Bearing in mind, like you said, you've ridden some of the best bikes in the world. You've definitely raced on some of the most amazing courses, locations. Is there anything left for you in the biking world in terms of a bucket list? Is it, you know, be it a route you want to ride or a race you want to compete in? Is there anything left for you to do? Have you literally done everything you set out to do?
I think the Le Mans, the 24-hour endurance race, is one I haven't done. I'd like to. Obviously, when you're a child, you dream of world championship and Grand Prix, but way past that now. You know, that won't happen, unfortunately. But that would be pretty grueling. But I think that almost a problem now is that doing the Dakar, which is the ultimate off-road, and the TT is the ultimate on-road race, in my opinion, that there isn't much else above that to kind of do in terms of bucket list, I suppose. But I'm happy just, you know, doing anything in motorcycle related. I'm keen. I'd like to do some more, perhaps not just yet, but a bit later on in life, do a bit more touring and long distance riding, you know, with camping, you know, camping out, and again with my old schoolmates and that, just to kind of get what I sort of spoke about earlier a little bit, the time away and just chatting and hanging out with bikes is, as I say, I think it's good for you, very healthy.
Obviously, that's in the future when we're all old and doing that type of thing, James, of course. But can you give us a little insight into the mindset, into the feelings, into the emotions of rolling up to the start line? As you said, you mentioned the Dakar, but for the TT or the Northwest, and you get, well, you basically sat waiting for your tap on the shoulder for your race with your own mortality, really, because you mention what the TT is and the finest of margins at the TT and how dialed in you have to be. Do you only experience that in the moment? Can you recreate that right now if you sat and closed your eyes and thought about it?
Not properly, no. I think, and again, because I've done, I mean, it never ever gets totally normal, but I don't know if either of you have ever been to the TT yet to kind of witness or feel that atmosphere on the start line.
That's our bucket list. Not been yet, mate.
I'm the other side of the fence, so I don't know. I feel pretty chilled out, weirdly. I never used to, like at TT now. I can't really explain it, but the way that you shake hands with your team members, usually my dad's there, so I shake hands, and then you get, there's like, it's kind of the no man's land between the kind of entrance gates up to the start line then, because it's 10 second intervals between riders. So you kind of line up, all the sounders and horns are gone off to give you kind of the countdown, 5 minutes, 3 minutes. And it is intense there. I almost go like shut down. It's weird. My ears and brain, it's almost just like muffle, you know, you don't really hear anything, and all I'm sort of focusing on then is the track ahead that you can see and the rider ahead. That's it's not like any other race where the mass start, where you kind of get a relation of where you are in the race. You know, you're on your own most of the race there, unless you can catch the rider in front. Then you know that's the best you can do initially, is just hit your markers and try and draw the rider in front in. So I guess that's main focus at the beginning of on the start line there. But it is a unique and iconic event in the way that there's no start light. You know, you wait for a little wave of the flag of the guy in front, and there's a guy, a bit like a hill climb time trial in a car, the start line guy would tap you on the shoulder when it's time to go, which is a historic and kind of unique part of that event, which it never becomes normal, but it also never wears off that. I don't know. I feel like that's my happy place. When I get there, it's just me and the motorcycle. It's
like, nothing else matters, does it?
No, no. It's so, there's always that element of unknown. You know, you just kind of, I always kind of say to myself, just, you know, do your thing, hit your markers and do your best. And that's, but there's also that massive amount of respect I always carry going into that. I never, you can never disrespect that place. It's so unforgiving. So it, but I think that's all part of the appeal for me, is the pressure to do the best I can without making a mistake. And I say to people, even a bad TT is, as long as you cross that finish line and even if you don't get the results you want, you will still afterwards, you know, at some point you might be a bit annoyed at initially, you know, if there's something held you back or you've had struggled with something, but you've still ticked off another race at the Isle of Man TT, and I think that's something a lot of people dream of doing. So
just listen to you there, James, and I can't believe I've not asked you this before, Ewan, because my experience of playing football, because of it being a team sport, is slightly different. But that moment that James is talking about, Ewan, that moment when you go to the start line and you're waiting for the gun to go off, anything that James is saying there, does it resonate with what you're saying? Yes, yours is a physical in a different way, to a certain degree. But that is, it boils down to having, like I said, a team sport background. You're hoping that the other 10 people are going to do all right, but unless you're doing a relay, Ewan, it's basically down to you guys, isn't it? That clock ticks down. No one else can do it but you two.
There's a lot of comparisons there. I really enjoyed hearing you say about, you're almost like in a Zen state, aren't you? Yes, you know the task ahead, but you know your skill level, so you're kind of quite calm. I suppose the difference is, for me, before a race, I needed to be pumped up and angry and aggressive to go. You can't be like that. You have to really maintain your heart rate. Don't go aggressive and too quick because you make mistakes. But here's one for you. I was going to ask you then, bearing in mind you've spoken so well about the TT and the fact that you're almost at peace with it at the start, what's harder for you then? I'd be interested to know, getting to sleep the night before, because obviously you're thinking about it, you're going through the route in your mind, or getting to sleep after the race when surely your adrenaline, you're buzzing, you've been successful. What's harder, the night before to sleep or the night off?
I don't know. I think earlier days, the night before was always hard because you're going through everything. But now, oddly, I sleep pretty good the night before. You know, I think because I know I need to sleep to rest, to be in the best possible shape I can be, I kind of have managed to just switch off now. But one thing that is tricky is your kind of body clock changes a little bit at the Isle of Man. And it's not so much now, but in years gone by, we used to do an evening practice. And you may get off the bike at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the evening. And you're like completely wired, you know, so you get into bed and you're just staring at the ceiling because you've gone from, you know, to 200 mile an hour, to then just lying in a bed and your ears are ringing, your eyes are just on stalk. So, you know, that is certainly one thing that, and another thing I struggle with, or can be an issue, is pre-event, you know, I will watch onboard laps from YouTube or something. And I definitely can't watch those too near a bedtime because it starts like revving me up, I suppose. And so I have to kind of govern and cap that for earlier in the day.
It never ceases to fascinate me because basically we're watching the same things on YouTube, you and I, James. I do that and then just kind of fall into a really exhausted heap of thinking, my God, that's terrifying, but exhilarating at the same time. And speaking of exhilarating, over the course of what we've spoken about and all the different strands of what you've covered from a motorcycling point of view, is there a hero in there for you that stands out in the different, either the different disciplines or an overarching one that sums it all up for you?
I would say I've got a lot of heroes, really, in the TT history. I suppose that all to a degree, all TT races are heroes for you know, because you don't, it never gets put in front of you or handed to you. Everyone who's there competing has had to want to do it and work their way up through wherever to fund it and get the license to do it and things. So, but my biggest, there's a few really, biggest is probably Joey Dunlop with what he achieved there. And also the way he did his work, you know, he was so humble and quiet, and you know, in a lot of sports now, more so, lately than ever. There's a lot of big egos, and I don't like that in people. Really, it winds me up, and I can't watch them. You know, I like people that do their sort of talking in when they're doing what they love, and so you know it. But Joey Dunlop, Steve Hislop, Bruce Anstey is another one, very quiet, but unbeatable if he was on the day. If he was on his gay A game, then no one would beat him. But and also, I've got to say, like more recently, Michael Dunlop, with what he's achieved in recent years, is incredible. Yeah. And now even John McGuinness, you know, and quite sort of fortunate to say we've over the years become quite good friends, which I still probably pinch myself about that, really, because when in my younger life I was, you know, I suppose he still is a hero, really, and I look up to him from what he's achieved. But I think more so in road racing, there's a lot of setbacks and potential, so many reasons to stop a lot of the time, and if you mention it, then there's probably a lot of people that would quite quickly convince you to retire, whereas it's, you've got to be quite headstrong in many ways. But I think it's, I feel like I'm going off a little bit on one here, but it's...
No.
I genuinely felt we spoke about the age thing, but I thought by the age I'm at now, nearly 40, I'd be winding up and looking at other options in life. But the older I get, the more aware I'm becoming that we're only here once, and I'm only getting older, and my body's stuck. You know, we're all probably on the downslope now, aren't we? We're past our peak athletic ability. And
I've been on a downslope for 20 years, mate.
So what I'm saying is I just think it's crucial to cram as much in and do more as you know. There's always reasons not to do stuff in life, and I try to find reasons why I can't not do it. You know, I'm hungry to achieve things, not always to win, but just for my own sanity and satisfaction to achieve something and get the best out of myself.
Well, you've achieved something by coming on here, mate. We've absolutely loved it. We were going to end with our final question, because Prats and myself, we always think music and riding go hand in hand. So my question is, you've got a dream ride.
Yeah.
You're listening to whatever music you want, and you're on your dream motorcycle. I think I know the answer to it. You sound like you've described the journey with your mates already, but if you could ride your bike anywhere in the world, where would it be? What bike would it be? Who you're with, and what are you listening to?
Bloody hell. There's quite a lot to answer there. It sounds silly. I don't listen to a lot of music. But we did recently a Vegas trip, and this wouldn't definitely not be my dream bike by a long way, but credit where it's due, it was quite satisfying. We hired some Harley Davidsons and rode to the Grand Canyon and they had the speakers on, and we had some typical, like, I made a Vegas playlist, but there was a few rock songs. I couldn't even tell you what they were, but they were iconic, like real goosebump making kind of,
yeah, your classic American highway road trip songs. I can picture it, I can hear it now, mate.
Yeah, it was so it was just awesome, you know, and I never ever thought I'd say that about riding a Harley Davidson ever, and I won't be buying one anytime soon, but it was so fun, you know. It was and again, I think going back to what we've touched on a few times, it doesn't always matter what bike you're on or where it is, but it's that sensation, and it's probably more your mental state at the time and who you're with and, you know, what you're talking about, I suppose. So it was, I haven't really answered any of those, have I, any of your questions, but...
No, do you know what? You have, because in a weird way, it might not have been your dream bike. You can't remember the music, but you remember the time, and you were with some good people, and the bike was right for the location. And yeah, it's lovely.
I think that's my relationship with music. If I heard the song now, I'd take me straight back, you know, and I don't really listen to the words in songs, but when I hear something, it triggers a memory of a drive in our old Ford Sierra, driving to somewhere, or you know, wherever it might have been, or riding a Harley Davidson to the Grand Canyon. It's that kind of, that's how my brain works. But I was smiling anyway, and it makes me smile now thinking about it.
Well, I mean, there's a school of thought that says the words in a song make you think about stuff, and the music makes you feel. So that's literally what that is. That's you dialed into the bike, both emotionally and mentally, and being able to kind of, as you say, if that tuner comes on, it'll take you straight back to the place, won't it? It won't be the words that take you back. It'll be the chords. It'll be the drums. It'll be the melody that takes you back. Be amazing if it was like the Venga Boys,
Thunderstruck,
or something. Oh, AC/DC, there you go. Perfect.
We had on.
Absolutely perfect.
And then we were riding down the strip in Vegas with Elvis Presley, yes. Viva Las Vegas, full volume. So we looked like absolute idiots, but it was we didn't care. We were living in the moment. It was like a race.
Living
start.
The dream. Living the dream.
Every set of traffic lights was a race start, and it was fun. Yeah, so fun.
The real duality of that, it made me think about when you're on the Hondas as well. There'd be people looking over, whether they're passing judgment on this group of fellas on Harleys or this group of fellas on Hondas. And if you take your helmet off and you've got someone who's mastered the Isle of Man TT, I think you quite swiftly get back in your box. Imagine you and me and you there taking the, oh, sorry, it's James Hillier. You really do know what you're doing on a motorbike. So I'll shut up. You can do what you want.
I do often think that.
Oh, I've loved it.
On the C90, I'm kind of incognito, and people are obviously going to judge me with my Rickman screen, and they might be overtaking me on the dual carriageway, but little do they know what my day job is. So
I got the TT in my back pocket, my word.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, James, I mean, sadly, unfortunately, that's about it for this week's full chat. It's been amazing. Powered, of course, by Bike Shores, the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. Bike Show will tailor quotes to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
As ever, I've got to say a huge thank you to our guest. I'll tell you what, Prats, this series two, we're knocking out of the park.
Amazing,
we've had some amazing guests. And James Hillier, you have been an absolute delight. Thank you for being with us today. It's been awesome.
No problem. Thank you. We'll get a plan for that ride, finish that ride off.
Definitely.
Love to. I quite like the sound of the Vegas and the Thunderstruck ones. But that's a different thing altogether. Wishing you, James, all the best on your travels. I mean, you're doing so many things that I just wish you all the best for everything that you're doing in your life. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
And don't forget to follow us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss another wonderful episode like this. Or you can watch it all, if you have done, like you have done today on YouTube.
As ever, thank you so much for watching and listening. It's been absolutely a total blast. Until next time, see you later.